The killing in Sudan is a stain on the entire international community, so says the United Nations. What will it take to finally stop it?
Leverage. That's always been the key variable, and it's always been the missing variable.
I'm Carolyn Beeler, today with the latest from Sudan. Also today in Chile, the perception of rising crime rates among voters doesn't square with reality.
The level of fear in the citizenry has much more to do with social interactions, the role of the media, but it's not really a result of a very sharp increase in crime.
And deaf athletes from around the world are heading to Tokyo to compete. Many don't get much support from their governments back home.
So always feel it's a little bit of a pill to swallow.
That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening today. The top human rights official at the United Nations is making an urgent call for action in Western Sudan. Here's Volker Turk speaking in Geneva earlier today about what's been happening in the Sudanese city of Al-Fashir.
The atrocities that are unfolding in Al-Fashir were foreseen and preventable, but they were not prevented. They constitute the gravest of crimes.
Last month, the Rapid Support Forces, a Sudanese paramilitary group, took control of Al-Fashir. Since then, the world has watched as troops from the RSF committed mass killings of civilians, sexual violence, attacks on health facilities, and other atrocities. Khulod Kher is the head of Confluence Advisory, a think tank founded in Sudan. We reached her in the United Kingdom. And she says the Rapid Support Forces are now focusing their attention to the east.
So taking Al-Fashir has allowed them to redeploy some of the soldiers that were part of the Al-Fashir campaign into the Kordofan region. The Kordofan region is in the southwest of the country, and it has become the new epicenter of the war in Sudan. And it's pretty make or break for both SAF and the RSF. That's the Sudanese Armed Forces. The SAF wants to maintain its grip on the Al-Obayid, that's the capital of North Darfur State, and the RSF have been besieging that town for well over a year, and they're trying to take it over much in the same way that they took over Al-Fashir. Siege, starvation, and then eventually military takeover.
So do you see what happens in this next area as kind of the tipping point?
I think in many ways, Al-Fashir was the tipping point. Certainly, we have seen that reverberate beyond Sudan into the Gulf region with Saudi and the Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates both reacting and involving Washington. Because of the how large of a takeover and how significant Al-Fashir was. But I think what we're going to see in Kordofan is going to be pretty significant for some of those supply lines, for some of the ethnic tensions that are embroiled in this war, as well as for the RSF's route back into the center, back into Khartoum, as they see it in the next part of their military campaign. Now, it's just the beginning of the dry season. And so we're really going to see, you know, for the next several months, up until June of next year, very heavy fighting on the ground, in the air, particularly using drones to try and, you know, sort of win out in this war of attrition.
Mm. We've heard that the UN is investigating the crisis in Sudan. It held that emergency meeting today. What can, if anything, the United Nations do at this point to help stop this war?
Well, we've not really heard much from the United Nations as a body, other than words of condemnation, words of regret. But really, it's been a lot of piecemeal gestures by the United Nations and member states of the United Nations, including very powerful member states, the United States, the United Kingdom, and others, have not really shown that they're able to do much. So it's very frustrating.
Can you talk more about that as a Sudanese person yourself, watching all of this from afar, your frustration, you said?
You know, Sudanese civil society has been speaking to the members of the P5, that's the UK, the US, France, and to some degree China and Russia, for over 18 months. The Yale Conflict Observatory, again, for over 18 months, has been saying that Al-Fashir will fall into the hands of the RSF, and when it does, we will see serious atrocities taking place. This has all been predicted, and yet no one lifted a finger at any stage, not when Zemzem was taken over and we saw a violent atrocity by the RSF carried out earlier this year in April, and not even in the run-up to, in the last few weeks before Al-Fashir fell at the end of October, we didn't see any action whatsoever. And 20 years ago, when the United Nations, the United States declared that there was a genocide or declared that there was a famine, there was an international architecture that was triggered that would respond to the famine, that would respond to atrocities by, for example, putting in place a protection of civilians mission or peacekeeping mission. This time round, none of those tools seem to be working, and the international community has not come up with any kind of tools that may be right for this moment.
The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio this week did call for international action to stop the flow of weapons to the RSF. You have said there have been a lot of words specifically from the U.N., but not a lot of action. Do you see that statement as any different?
It's significant in that, you know, Marco Rubio spoke quite off the cuff in great detail about some of the atrocities that have been happening in El Fasher. So to some degree, it indicates that the United States is seen with what's going on in Sudan, but we know that the ceiling of ambition for the United States is simply a ceasefire. It is not a longer term, sort of peace process. And what that means is that a lot of these statements that come out, including from Washington, could just be, you know, a flash in the pan rather than indicative of a greater commitment to stop the war.
Mm. For years, this conflict has been called the one that the world is not paying attention to. That has clearly changed in recent months. We've been talking about the UN and U.S. officials talking about this. Does that make any kind of difference that leaders are now publicly paying more attention to Sudan?
I think there's certainly more attention, but policymakers have always had good intelligence and good data. So, you know, lack of media attention is not really an excuse for lack of political action. But I think what we're seeing is that also the international community seems to have, you know, set a standard where mere condemnation is action. And of course, that is not action. Those are words. There is a more of a conflict management attempt now rather than a conflict resolution attempt.
What will it take at this point to stop the violence in Sudan?
Leverage. That's always been the key variable, and it's always been the missing variable. There needs to be serious leverage on the Sudanese parties, but serious leverage also on external backers. Unless that leverage is fully applied, we're not going to see the SAF and the RSF agree to this humanitarian truce. Now, bearing in mind, this is a humanitarian truce that we're talking about today, a three-month humanitarian truce, potentially extended to 9 months. So there's a sequencing issue here as well. The U.S. seems to be pushing for a ceasefire first and a political agreement second. Historically, that has never borne fruit in Sudan. It's always been a political agreement that has, you know, forced armed actors to lay down their weapons. And I don't think this is going to be any different. And I think that lays a focus on a ceasefire, which means a laser focus on those who are holding the guns, obfuscates the extent to which it will actually need to be civilians, non-armed actors that keep the peace and actually lay the foundations for a Sudan where interminable war is not the norm.
A Sudan where interminable war is not the norm. Khulod Kher is the head of a think tank called Confluence Advisory. She spoke with us from the UK. To South America now, where voters in Chile head to the polls this weekend. They're choosing a new president and members of the national legislature. The elections come after years of unrest, two failed attempts to rewrite the country's constitution, and growing fears about crime. Polling shows that politics are tilting toward the right. The World's Tibis Isaiah reports.
In Latin America, Chile stands out as a prosperous democracy, one that rebuilt itself after a brutal military dictatorship. It's also long been one of the safest countries in the region, but that sense of stability is starting to feel fragile. There's been a rise in violent crime, and polls show that around 60% of Chileans now see security as their number one concern.
La sensación de inseguridad en Santiago es increíble. O sea, uno ya prácticamente no puede estar de noche tranquilo.
Hugo Piñera says in Santiago, the capital, he feels nervous going out at night or even pulling into his driveway, afraid someone might rob his car or assault him. Police data confirm there's been an increase in homicides, and headlines now talk about gruesome crimes, contract killings, extortion, kidnappings, things that were once rare in Chile. Now they dominate headlines and political debates.
Bala o cárcel para los criminales.
Persigamos a los que tienen aquí el control del dinero, del narco y el crimen.
All eight presidential candidates are putting security at the center of their campaigns. Analysts say when security tops the agenda, voters tend to favor the political right. Far-right candidate José Antonio Kast is promising what he calls an iron fist approach to crime and migration. He's built his campaign around a plan he calls Border Shield and compares his border policies to those of Donald Trump.
El plan Escudo Fronterizo construirá un blindaje real. Zanjas, muros, torres.
It proposes ditches, fences, and walls across Chile's borders with Peru and Bolivia, a region that has seen a surge of migrants from Venezuela.
Chile ha sido invadido. La inmigración ilegal, el crimen organizado.
In another ad, Kast says Chile has been invaded by immigrants and criminals and promises to, quote, put Chileans first. Claudia Heiss is a political scientist at the University of Chile, and she says much of the fear around security comes from perception rather than reality.
We have a sense of danger of being attacked by criminals that doesn't match really the victimization data. There are many studies that show that the level of fear in the citizenry has much more to do with social interactions, the role of the media, but it's not really a result of a very sharp increase in crime.
According to official data, yes, homicides have nearly doubled in recent years and foreign gangs are now active in Chile. But crime rates are still a fraction of those in places like Colombia, Mexico, or Ecuador. Heiss says the focus on security has pushed other important issues like healthcare, pensions, and education to the background of this election. Kast and two other right-wing candidates are expected to command about 60% of the vote. But Heiss says the appeal of a tough-on-crime message is only part of the story. Because for the first time in over a decade, voting is mandatory, and that is bringing millions of new voters to the polls.
I think this is really, really important. We will have around 5 million people voting who are not interested in politics, who have never voted before, who are not very informed, and who are more prone to emotional campaigns.
She says some people will go to vote without wanting to.
They will say, oh, the politicians are forcing me to vote. I don't want to vote. So it's a vote with rage, with anger.
And angry voters, she says, often benefit extreme positions. Pablo Abufón, an activist in Santiago, is concerned about the fact that some right-wing candidates openly admire Chile's former dictator, Augusto Pinochet.
This is sad because the dictatorship was a 17-year-long massacre. Several thousands of people were disappeared, slaughtered, tortured, and so it's not easy to see that people are trying to reclaim that as a proper legacy of democracy.
One of Chile's three right-wing candidates is likely to come out on top, but much will depend on undecided voters, especially the youngest ones. And they are being wooed with musical videos and jingles all over TikTok and YouTube.
No soy Kast, no soy Jara, soy Evelyn mirando pa' delante.
Polls show four candidates don't have much of a chance, and the race will likely come down to José Antonio Kast and Janet Jara, the Communist Party candidate. Neither is expected to win an outright majority, so a runoff is likely on December 14th. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isea.
The Tehran Symphony Orchestra has been performing for nearly 100 years, but it was not until this week that it put on a performance that was conducted by a woman. That story is just moments away. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This week marked a historic moment in Iran's music scene. For the first time, a woman conductor led Tehran's symphony orchestra, overcoming barriers that have been in place for decades. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
Panisvar Yousafi led the orchestra, composed of male and female musicians. This is the first time that a woman leads the Tehran Symphony Orchestra. The performance featured works by both Iranian and international composers. Far Yousafi spoke with Iranian media about her achievement. To me, gender is not important in arts, she said. But in Iran, it's rare to have female conductors. For the past four decades, since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the government has imposed restrictions on female musicians. Women are not allowed to sing solo at public concerts with mixed genders. But women have consistently pushed the boundaries, creating openings to showcase their art. Globally, we are seeing more and more female conductors, Far Yousafi told Iran's state media. And I hope this opens the path to those who are eager to enter this field. Before Far Yousafi, another female conductor, Nosrat Amiri, led the National Orchestra in 2018. Far Yousafi was born in Iran to musician parents. She was trained both in the country and abroad in Armenia. She said this week's performance was a testament to the power of female musicians. Peyman Soltani, a musician and orchestra conductor in Tehran, says Iran doesn't have that many conductors, male or female. This is a weakness, he told Radio Free Europe. We need to do more to train and prepare the next generation of conductors. Soltani applauded the fact that the authorities have given permission to Far Yousafi to conduct the orchestra, but he also cautioned against seeing this as an end to discrimination against women in music in Iran. Actions like these are only good if they're permanent, he said. But we see that one day a woman leads an orchestra, and then 2-3 months later, these actions are reversed. Still, at Unity Hall in Tehran this week, the audience seemed to savor the moment. Wearing a long black robe and a sparkly head wrap, Far Yousafi dedicated her performance to the women of Iran. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The Winter Olympic and Paralympic Games are in just a few months. But before then, another international athletic event starts this weekend in Tokyo. It was once known as the International Silent Games. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
The International Silent Games started in 1924, decades before even the Paralympics. Then it became the World Games of the Deaf. And now it's the Deaflympics, a name that has stuck since 2001. They are just like the Olympics and Paralympics, after all. The Deaflympics opening ceremony has a parade of nations, live performances, and a lighting of the torch to mark the start of the games. This year in Tokyo, around 3,000 athletes from 80 countries will compete across nearly two dozen sports. There's everything from basketball and wrestling to cycling and tennis. Hearing aids and cochlear implants are not allowed during any of the competitions. But otherwise, all of the rules are the same as mainstream sports. There are just some additional visual cues, like lights to start a track race, and referees using flags in addition to whistles. Chris Ratcliffe represented Great Britain in water polo at the 1985 Deaflympic Games.
Yeah, my experience was a really positive one. Made lifelong friends.
Ratcliffe stayed in the deaf sports world long after retiring from competition. He's now the CEO of UK Deaf Sport, which is helping dozens of athletes on Team Great Britain get to this year's games. And they do that on their own dime, Ratcliffe says.
In the UK, the government doesn't recognise the Deaflympics, nor does it fund our deaf athletes.
No funding from the government, compared to a record $450 million that will be invested in Great Britain's Olympians and Paralympians over the next few years.
So it always feels like a little bit of a bitter pill to swallow.
Deaf athletes get around that by setting up fundraisers, applying for grants, and for a few, signing deals with sponsors. Even athletes who do get government funding, like in Canada, Spain, Ukraine, and Poland, say the support is often not enough. Still, the vast majority of the Deaflympics community would prefer to stay separate from the Paralympics, which currently does not have any categories for deaf or hard of hearing people. Deaflympians say they should get the resources and attention they deserve without having to attach themselves to a different event. Ratcliffe has an additional idea.
The ideal scenario for me would be that we would have the Deaflympics running just after the Paralympics. And so that would be a true global celebration of sport, recognising everybody from Olympics, Paralympics and Deaflympics.
For now, organisers are working to boost turnout and build more visibility for the athletes who are ready to compete in Tokyo. The Japanese government even helped launch a campaign to teach fans how to visually cheer on the deaf athletes. One of the cheers involves holding both hands up by your ears, shaking them with excitement, then pushing your arms forward, like sending energy straight to the field of play. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
There were two big winners last night in Las Vegas at the 2025 Latin Grammy Awards. The first was very much expected. The Puerto Rican megastar Bad Bunny took home 5 Grammys.
Gracias.
He won Best Album and Best Urban Song of the Year for DTMF. Hey, que prendan la máquina, voy pa' Santurce. Aquí todavía se da caña, chequeate la baby, diablo, mami, qué dulce. Hoy yo quiero beber. Beber, beber, y hablar mierda hasta que me pulsen. There was, though, also a surprise winner last night, the hip-hop and soul duo Catriel and Paco Amoroso from Argentina. They tied Bad Bunny with 5 Grammys of their own, including Best Pop Song and Best Alternative Song. But it was their extravagant live performance that stole the show. It featured mountains of textile, outlandish costumes, and dancers galore. The duo ran through a medley of their experimental hits, including this one called El Día del Amigo. Coming up on the show, everything you ever wanted to know about living in space, specifically on the International Space Station. A conversation with an Italian astronaut. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. About 8 billion people live here on Earth. A new television documentary takes us to a place that fewer than 300 humans have inhabited.
Since the turn of the century, a few have been living here. The most hazardous scientific outpost ever built. The International Space Station.
The International Space Station, a home for astronauts in space. It is the subject of a new 2-part documentary, Operation Space Station, from our colleagues at NOVA. One of the people we meet in that documentary is Italian astronaut Luca Parmitano. He is among the lucky few to have lived at the ISS. Luca, can you describe what it looks like for us, the ISS, so we can kind of imagine being there throughout this conversation?
Sure. The ISS is larger than most people think. That is the first thing that I want people to understand. A lot of time I'm asked, hey, how could you spend a year in such a small place? But the ISS is really big. Imagine the inside of a 747 jumbo jet and then break it into smaller rooms that are spread all over different directions. And then the main color, at least on the American segment, American, European, Japanese segment, is white. So all the walls are white. but you have all these racks, and each rack is either a container for storage or an experiment or a system. So some racks are used for computers and radio communication and satellite communication. Other are experiments, so science labs. And then behind others, you just find our food, our clothes, our storage locations. And we live in any of these parts during our day. We float freely from one segment to another, depending on what we have to do for a task on that specific time.
You mentioned that the U.S., Japanese, European, I think, section was white. What are the other sections? What countries do they represent?
So the space station has four parts, I would say. The biggest part is the American segment, which comprises the Node 1, the U.S. lab, Node 2, Node 3, the Cupola, the PMM. So those are all names of modules. And then you have the European segment, which is called Columbus, and the Japanese segment, which is called Kibo. And then if you go from Node 1, which is right at the center of the space station, you go aft into the Russian segment. And the Russian segment has different colors. They tend to be sort of pinkish or khaki colored. They are different shaped compared to the USOS segment. And they're also slightly smaller in general. And that's why I said that the other part is white. It's really this contrast between the two different sides of the space station. You can tell at a glance by the color of the walls.
And that is a good illustration of the internationalness of the International Space Station. It is shared by five different space agencies. And each of those sections were built by different space agencies, right? The U.S., Russia, Europe, Japan, and Canada. Is that kind of collaboration unusual in space or elsewhere in science?
I would say that in science in general, it is not unusual because science has such an objective common goal, which is the betterment of our knowledge and the improvement of our condition as humans, that it really is a global cooperation. Really, science transcends borders and nationalities and heritage. For space, the International Space Station is to this day a very unique experience, however, because there is no other example prior to the International Space Station that comprises so many different countries. The European Space Agency represents 22 countries. And then you have, like you said, Canada, Russia, Japan. And the common effort has validated our purpose to this day. And it is a reminder that when we want, as humans, we are really capable of achieving incredible things by really overcoming our differences.
Mm. That collaboration allowed this to happen, right? It wouldn't have been too much of an expense for just one country to foot the bill.
Well, it was, yes, you are correct. It would be impossible nowadays for any individual country to operate a space station like the International Space Station. It's too big, too complex. On the other hand, the space station was built on purpose in such a way that the elements had to be so integrated that it could not be operated without the support of all the different sides. It really is one common space station that has to be operated by all the different partners.
It sounds like you might be hinting toward the idea that the space station is, in just a few years, going to be retired, which I do want to talk about a little bit later in this interview. But first, I want to get to your experience in space, especially a particularly dramatic episode. But first, so you first went up into space in May of 2013. What first struck you about actually being up there after having thought about it for so long? Like, do you remember your first night in the ISS?
I certainly do. I remember really well flying into the space station after docking. And I was amazed at how comfortable I felt with what it looked like, because I had spent so much time in the simulations, in training, in the mock-ups, in the simulators, that I felt as though a lot of it was familiar, even though it was new and different. Mm. And of course, the main difference is that now you're weightless. And so that surprised me, the fact that I felt familiar. But one thing that you can never, never get used to in terms of wrapping your head around it is weightlessness. Mm-hmm. I could never get tired of it. There was never one day that I woke up and thought, oh my gosh, I wish so much that I had gravity right now.
You enjoyed it the whole time being weightless.
Every single second.
I'm speaking with Italian astronaut Luca Parmitano, who's lived and worked at the International Space Station. He is featured in a new documentary from NOVA called Operation Space Station. Luca, the second spacewalk that you went on back in your trip to the ISS in 2013, something went very wrong during it. When did you realize that something bad was happening?
So you have to understand that a spacewalk is an extremely controlled experience. We train on the ground first in many different ways. We train underwater. We train in virtual reality. We train in mock-ups. We know our spacesuit. We know what it should feel like. And during that second spacewalk, about maybe half an hour into it, I felt something cold and wet on the back of my head, water. And there shouldn't be any reason why water is present inside the spacesuit. Even though the spacesuit is refrigerated using water, there is a system that basically makes very cold water flow in around your body so that it takes away the heat of your body. But that system is isolated and it should never come inside the spacesuit. So the fact that I felt that water surprised me, and I knew something was wrong and in that second. And I reacted the way we are trained. I stopped what I was doing, and I told the ground control, FYI, there's some water in my helmet.
And Luca, we actually have a clip of that moment from the NOVA film. We can play it right now.
Hey, Luca, can you clarify, is it increasing or not increasing?
It's hard to tell, but it feels like a lot of water.
Oh, I see. I see it now, wiggling.
I don't understand where it's coming from. It can't be the water.
It has to be the bag.
There are three voices there. One is ground asking me to confirm whether it's increasing. And then I answer, I don't know, but it feels like a lot of water. And the third voice is Chris Cassidy, that it's actually out there with me. And he's looking inside the helmet and he's confirming, oh, I see it. He's
your fellow astronaut who you're floating around the space station with.
That's right. Yes. Chris Cassidy, he was out there with me and he was confirming that he could see the water crawling on top of my head.
So this blob of water is at the back of your head, but as you move, it gets closer and closer to your nose and mouth, which, of course, could eventually drown you. How did you try to stay calm during that moment?
So at first, I was really more annoyed with the idea that it was going to get inside my ears. Just like on Earth, when you know, if you're taking a shower and you get a drop of water inside your ear, then you have to shake it out because otherwise it feels like everything is dimmed and maybe one ear sounds really loud and the other one doesn't sound so good. So I was more annoyed at the thought than worried. Initially, the point where things became a little bit more dicey is when I made a maneuver that I had to do with my body in order to translate back to the airlock. And that maneuver caused the water to slosh around and cover my eyes and my nose completely. And because it was night, at that moment, I lost situational awareness. I really couldn't tell which way I was supposed to be going, and I couldn't see well. I couldn't see at all because the lights on our helmets really create a cone of light right in front of you. And it's not enough to really have a sense of where things are in the big scheme. So,
and how far away were you from the ISS at this moment?
So I was still attached to the ISS. We don't let go of the space,
right,
of the space station itself, but I had to go back to the airlock, which is our door inside the space station. I was about 85 feet, which doesn't seem like a lot, but when you are crawling on your hands and you have to use very specific handrails and you cannot see them, all at once, it can take a long time. Mm-hmm. And it did take me about 7 minutes to get back to the airlock.
And how long after the water had covered your nose and started to impede your breathing, I would imagine, was it before you were able to get inside of the airlock and take your helmet off and address the situation?
I would say it took me another 6 minutes to get back inside, 6-7 minutes without any communication to the ground or from the ground. Even though I was talking the whole time, none of the sound made it out of the...
Oh, they couldn't hear you, and you probably couldn't hear them.
That's right.
So when you got back inside of the space station and the airlock, you then waited for your fellow astronaut, Chris Cassidy, to also get into the airlock. And we have a clip of when you meet each other in there.
Squeeze my hand if you're fine. Here, squeeze my hand. Everything okay? You okay?
So tell me what's happening there.
So Chris is trying to tell me how am I doing? You know, I'm not moving because every time I move, any minimal motion sloshes the water around my face and it's really uncomfortable. So Chris is asking me, hey, are you okay? Are you okay? And I have no idea that he's asking me anything because I cannot hear him. And that's when Chris just reaches with his gloved hand and grabs my glove and squeezes it. And we had not briefed this. We had not talked about, hey, not being able to talk to each other. But that's such a universal contact, you know. It's somebody reaching out and squeezing your hand. And so I just squeezed back. And then Chris kind of contorted himself a little bit to try to see me. And that's when he said, he told the ground, Luca is fine. He looks miserable, but he's fine.
Wow. That must have been a very comforting hand squeeze for both of you.
It was for me. It filled me with love for my friend and crewmate. I knew that he had my back and he was doing what he could to make it as fast as possible. Mm. And it was just very comforting to receive that hand squeeze. It's like, I'm here with you.
So, Luca, this is not, you know, the only mishap that has happened on the International Space Station. Space travel is inherently risky. How do you think about the risk involved in space travel and whether it is worth it?
Well, risk is a mathematical computation. And if you put it on a graph, you have the chance that something happens on one side and then on the other. On the other coordinate, you have what are the consequences of that event happening, and that's how you calculate the risk. And when you put it in those simple terms, really, what we do as astronauts is try to minimize the chance that something with dire consequences can happen. And it's really simple. That's all it is. We understand that there is risk. We understand that every time we strap to a rocket, there's going to be some risk connected to it. Every time we try to create a maneuver with the space station, every time we go outside, there is some risk connected to it. But our engineers and the entire agency, not only NASA, but the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency, the Canadian Space Agency, Roscosmos for their activities, they do everything they can so that the risk is known and is minimized.
So as of now, the International Space Station is supposed to be wind down operations by the end of 2030, when it will eventually crash into the Pacific Ocean. How do you feel about the ISS closing down in 5 years?
So for me, it's a bittersweet sensation. I knew when I undocked in February of 2020, I knew that was my goodbye to the space station. And that understanding, that knowledge brought me peace. I knew that I wasn't going to go back. And I knew that my experience was that I'd given everything I could. All I could to my 366 days on the space station. But it's bittersweet because that experience allows me to be able to contribute nowadays to what is happening 5 years later, and to what will be happening in the next 10 years. And so I'm grateful to have had that privilege, and I will certainly be looking up when the space station comes down, and I wouldn't be surprised if a few tears came into my eyes.
Luca Parmitano is an Italian astronaut. His experience living at the International Space Station is part of a new documentary from NOVA, Operation Space Station. Luca, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Russia's missile and drone strikes in Kyiv last night have Ukrainians there on edge heading into winter. And Ukraine has just struck a key Russian oil port. What to make of these recent developments in that war? Just ahead on today's show, you are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. People in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv had yet another long and terrifying night. At least six people were killed by a Russian drone that hit an apartment block, and dozens more were injured. A military official in Ukraine said that practically every district of the city was targeted in the overnight attack. Ukraine has stepped up strikes of its own inside Russia as the Russian military is advancing into key areas on the front lines in eastern Ukraine. That includes a street-to-street fight for the city of Pokrovsk. Maria Zolkina is the head of regional security and conflict studies at the Democratic Initiatives Foundation, a Kyiv-based think tank.
So basically what has happened last night is another just night attack, and the character of these attacks is getting more and more severe with every week, I have to say, because the idea right now, as we can understand, is to organize a shutdown in terms of electricity grid not functioning, and plus the terror of civilian population. So basically, if we assess this kind of attacks on civilian infrastructure and civilian residential buildings, so this night is one of many during this autumn, but it's much more severe when in comparison with let's say, even the first years of the war.
Mm. These were drone strikes and also missile attacks. There was a time when very few missiles got through Ukraine's air defense system. What has changed?
The tactics of Russian air forces has changed this year, especially within the last 5 to 6 months. So I will explain just previously, Russia used to use the tactics when they sent several drones, sometimes several hundreds of drones and missiles simultaneously to different places all over Ukraine. And Ukraine is a large country, even now with 18% of the territories occupied. But within the last half of the year, Russia has significantly changed the whole scheme. Right now, the same amount, enormous amount of drones and missiles, they are sending precisely to one city or to one district within one city. And capital of Ukraine's Kyiv, it has one of the best air defense system in comparison to other parts of Ukraine, as you can imagine. So Kyiv have more or less enough air defense systems, but none of the air defense system can intercept several dozens of drones and missiles if they're coming simultaneously to one place. This is simply technically not possible.
So you're saying that a high concentration of missiles are being sent to one particular place, and that just overwhelms their defense systems?
Yes. Absolutely. And in particular, this year, Ukraine, despite of being under severe attacks like this night, Ukraine has a real problem with getting the sufficient number of missiles for air defense system.
Right. I did want to ask you about that. Patriot missiles as well as Tomahawk missiles have been top of the wish list for President Zelensky asking from the U.S. Where do those requests for more of those missiles stand right now?
Ukraine hasn't received any additional Patriot systems. I wouldn't say confirmed, but promised by Trump previously this year. And even getting Patriot systems is, again, every time a challenge. Ukraine is not getting them for free anymore. The quantity is limited, which is being sold by US through the pool system, the new scheme which Trump basically created. So the system when Europe pays and US is sending this.
What about Europe? European leaders last night condemned the attacks on Kyiv. What is Europe doing to help Ukraine either prevent these attacks or respond in kind?
Europe is doing their best to find money to supply weapons to Ukraine, including those for air defense. And for instance, the Russian frozen assets, which are being frozen since 2022, the assets of Russian Central Bank, that's about 190 billion euros. And right now, Europe is doing their best to use those money in order to buy weapons for Ukraine and to make some orders for public procurements when it comes to military production in Ukraine or in Europe. That's their main strategy right now, to find money for that.
I want to stay in the air for one more question here. Ukraine is also striking targets in Russia. What is Ukraine targeting? What is its strategy there? Is it also energy centers?
Ukraine has been trying to target oil refineries, petroleum production facilities in Russia, and has been being very successful with that, because not the oil sanctions, which are in force starting from 2023, are really limiting Russian oil exports, but basically striking with Ukraine-produced drones and with Ukraine-produced missiles. That's very important. So even without Tomahawk, Ukraine is trying to do that with its own resources and engineering forces. So producing the missiles and drones just to strike deep into oil refineries, just to make it impossible for Russia to sell oil and petroleum products on international markets. And basically, Ukraine has been very successful with that. For instance, this night, one of the biggest Russian oil refinery terminals, which is close to Novorossiysk port, this is the Russian port on the Black Sea, was targeted and was destroyed. So Russia has already moved its oil logistic chains to Baltic Sea, to Arctic, and to Far East.
Out of reach of Ukrainian missiles.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the ground war now for a moment. Russian ground forces have gained in places like around the city of Pokrovsk. How much are the front lines shifting, and is Russia moving forward more quickly than it has in the recent past?
The battle for Pokrovsk, it has been lasting for around 2 years and even more. The Ukrainian forces haven't stepped back there. However, there is a risk that at some point they might be, the logistical chains for supply might be cut off by Russian forces. If you look at the map, you can easily see that Pokrovsk might be in a kind of technical surrounding or encirclement by Russian forces at some point. So right now there is a, I would say, a challenge for Ukrainian military planning staff what to do, either to continue standing still back in Pokrovsk, and just to fill in the gaps with the new units redirected from other parts of the front line, or just to prepare just in case the way out from Pokrovsk. But Pokrovsk is really of critical importance for both sides, for Russian mainly political, but for Ukrainian side, if Pokrovsk is occupied once, which Ukrainian forces are trying to prevent right now, Russian forces will have an open way for Kramatorsk and Slavyansk, which are the main cities in Donetsk region, and more importantly, Dnipropetrovsk region, which is the very central part of Ukraine.
Maria Zolkina is with the Democratic Initiatives Foundation, a think tank based in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. Check out more of our reporting on YouTube and be sure to subscribe to our feed there. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. and by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.